Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions from this and many other independent community stations across the country. We bring local stories to a national audience from a different location every week. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio, produced weekly in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network.
Bethlehem is now completely cut off from Jerusalem.
The United States does not recognize Israel's claims to either East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem.
Today on Sprouts, we hear from attorney Francis A. Boyle, Harvard scholar and author of the new book Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law. Professor Mazen B. Kamsaya, formerly of the University of Tennessee, Yale, and Duke. He now does research at Bethlehem and Beersheba Universities. Professor Kamsaya is a well-known expert on Middle East genetics and author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. And Frank Berat, coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, held in early March in Barcelona. The tribunal found EU states in breach of international and internal European law with respect to protection of Palestinian human rights. At issue two is the matter of who provided the weapons to Israel used during attacks on Gaza. British lawmakers have called for a reevaluation of weapons deals with Israel. The Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem was built over the grotto where the Virgin Mary was said to have given birth to Jesus. For centuries, Christians have celebrated Palm Sunday there and have walked in the steps of early Christians, moving between Nazareth, Bethlehem, and Jerusalem to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. We're listening to the sounds of Franciscans moving through the streets of Jerusalem, bells of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and an Orthodox Christian choir. American Christians, in particular, may view this part of the world romantically, especially at Easter time, never realizing that yards away from the ancient holy sites, there is a life and death struggle going on for Palestinian Christians and Muslims, as well as for Jews. But even for those Palestinians who may be able to date ancestry and property rights back centuries, there is no guarantee that an Israeli official will not be knocking on the door with immediate eviction orders for the Jewish-only settlements the Israeli government intends to build, despite international law and despite world opinion. Professor Mazen B. Kamsaya, well known in both America and Palestine, engages in nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation.
When Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, they proceeded to build settlements all around the areas, including our area of Bethlehem. And in Bethlehem district now, there are 130,000 Palestinians who have use only of about 20% of the original land of the government of Bethlehem. So basically 80% of our land is now off limits to us. That had about 21 settlements built on it, to the north of us, to the west of us, and to the south and southeast of us. There's only one small area that remains without settlements around the district of Bethlehem. This results in the formation of a ghetto in Bethlehem, and Israel is making this ghetto literally in concrete by building the wall that's going around the area of Bethlehem. So the people of Bethlehem, Christian and Muslims, are not allowed to even get to Jerusalem except if they get a special permit. And very, very tiny minority of people are allowed to have this permit, usually people who collaborate with the Israelis or have special medical needs or something like that. So obviously we are not very satisfied with the status quo and have been pushing to eliminate this regime of special permits, so to speak, to enter our own city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is only 5 miles away from Bethlehem. We are literally just a suburb of Jerusalem. And so we have a situation where the suburbs of the city have been cut off from the main city.
On Palm Sunday, Professor Mazen Kamsaya and other Christians in Palestine were reminded of the limitations that have been imposed on their lives and their religious practice by Israel.
After the Palm Sunday church services in the morning, about 150 of us walked from the in front of the Church of Nativity after church services to the checkpoint, to the wall that is now built between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, and basically demanded our right to enter the city without these so-called special permits that are given to the selected few that Israel wants to allow to enter, as if the city is theirs. We demand our right per the international law, and international law is very clear that within a country, an occupying army cannot force people to remain in their villages and prevent freedom of movement. And certainly also there are other provisions of international humanitarian law that forbids the restrictions on the right of worship. And obviously, during Easter, many people want to go to the Church of the Sepulchre in Jerusalem and pray there. And Israel restricts and prevents Palestinians from going to their holy sites in Jerusalem, except, as I said, for the very few selected people. And it's arbitrary. Sometimes they decide it's by age. For example, they'll say people who are over age 55 can go, and sometimes people with special permissions can go, whatever. These are all illegal per international law. Israel cannot do these kinds of collective punishment of people by preventing thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people from getting to their city. So we wanted to just get in there, and we succeeded, actually, partially. We entered through an open gate. We forced our way through, and we succeeded in moving up to about 200 meters in, very close at the edge of the city of Jerusalem. We almost got to where we wanted to go. But the Israeli army forced us back and used force against arresting 16 people, later releasing 5 of them. There's 11 now left in jail. All the 11 are Palestinian. The 5 they released are 4 Israelis and 1 international who were supportive of us and came with us. We have all essentially violated Israeli law by entering that area. But of course, Israeli law, like any other law, if it contradicts with international law, the local people do not have to obey this law. Just like Nazi Germany had laws, but they were not fair or just laws, and certainly people should not have obeyed these laws. What we try to do is show that these are laws that are against international law, that they are certainly unfair and discriminatory and racist.
In an op-ed to Haaretz, David Landau writes about Israel sliding toward McCarthyism and racism. He writes, quote, "The battle line in Israel's war of survival as a Jewish and democratic state now runs through the Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem. There, alongside the few brave Israelis out demonstrating, the President of the United States has planted his pennant too. Is that the line at last where Israel's decline will be halted?" Professor Kumsaya, just talk about the importance of this city, Jerusalem.
Yes, in terms of Jerusalem, it's a very critical issue for the people here. The economy of the West Bank is actually heavily dependent on Jerusalem and vice versa, and that's why we have an economic crisis here with unemployment reaching twice what it was during the Great Depression in the U.S. We think that a way to address the issue of Jerusalem is that Jerusalem is a city of three faiths, people of various nationalities, various backgrounds, various ethnicities have and continue to live in Jerusalem over thousands of years. Only in the past 62 years, basically, since the foundation of the State of Israel, has the demographics of the city of Jerusalem been significantly impacted. And they were impacted, for example, in 1948, when all the Palestinian residents of West Jerusalem were pushed out. 28,000 Palestinians from the city itself were removed, plus many thousands more from the villages in West Jerusalem, which were ethnically cleansed in 1948. So West Jerusalem has become basically all Jewish, no Palestinians living there between 1948 and 1967. Of course, also a few thousand, I think it's 3,000 or 4,000 Jewish people who used to live in East Jerusalem moved to other areas after the war. But this has not stopped there, because in 1967, Israel occupied the eastern part of the city and proceeded to violate international law by bringing Israeli Jewish settlers into East Jerusalem. And today there are 230,000 Israeli Jewish colonial settlers in East Jerusalem. And they are spreading at the expense of the Palestinians in East Jerusalem, ethnically cleansing many of the Palestinians in East Jerusalem, including many who were made refugees in 1948, who were pushed out from West Jerusalem to East Jerusalem, and who are now losing their homes for the second time in places like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan and other places. Just the last 2 years, approximately 8,000 Palestinians were removed from East Jerusalem, where the Israeli government removed their right to live in the Arab city, and so basically they were ethnically cleansed. And plus, Israel has demolished over 5,000 homes in the past few years in East Jerusalem and continues to demolish homes in East Jerusalem. So this is the status in East Jerusalem. Israel aims to transform it into a Jewish city, the Jewish capital forever and ever, as they put it on their own website. If one goes to the Israeli Jerusalem municipality, it says very clearly that they want Jerusalem to have no more than 25% non-Jews in it, meaning that they have to reduce the non-Jewish presence in East Jerusalem and bring in more Jews. And that's what they have been doing for the past few decades.
You've been providing updates about Israel's arrest of award-winning journalist Mohammed Omar. Just comment on Israel's actions.
Israel has been cracking down on international activists and on Palestinians who are engaged in nonviolent resistance by arresting activists and, in many cases, torturing them, imprisoning them for long terms. Israel hopes to crush the popular resistance, because basically now there's hardly any violent resistance in the occupied areas. So the only resistance that remains and is deeply entrenched is the popular nonviolent resistance, and Israel wants to crush this. So people like Omar and many, many thousands of others have been harassed, have been detained, have been abused. In his case, a young journalist from Gaza, they took him and they beat him for many hours and prevented him from coming in and out many times to explain the situation of what happened to him. This is essentially has become routine for the occupation army here. But it is not stopping the popular resistance. In fact, we feel that it is strengthening us, because it's important for us to pursue what we are pursuing, which is a popular nonviolent resistance, to eventually end this unjust occupation and end these injustices once and for all.
Professor Kumsaya, I know you too were threatened by the Israeli government and not sure what might happen when you returned to Palestine from the U.S. recently. Your many friends here in Connecticut, where you taught at Yale University, and also around the world, wrote letters on your behalf.
We need to be thinking about the tens of thousands of Palestinians who are suffering as a result of engaging in nonviolent resistance. Because nonviolent resistance, by definition, as we know from the history of Mahatma Gandhi in India or other places, has consequences and has a price to pay. And sometimes this price is very small and sometimes it's very heavy. I mean, some people like Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi paid with their lives for it. And we have people here who paid with their lives for it. There are people who are in jail, who are tortured and beaten, and there are people who are harassed. And, you know, I am just one of the few people who was just harassed so far, has not really been subject to the kind of attacks that other people have been subjected to. I think we are at that stage of the game, so to speak, where in order to wake up the world conscience to the injustice happening here, we have to use boycott, divestments, and sanctions. I don't see a contradiction between boycotts, divestments, and sanctions and the popular resistance on the ground that is happening. In fact, they are complementary processes. And we in the popular movement, for example, in Beit Sahur, always speak about boycotts, divestments, and sanctions as one of many tools at our disposal that are nonviolent tools to resist the occupation.
Professor Mazen Kumsaya joining us from Palestine. You can find information about the popular resistance movement there at his blog. He calls it The Musings of a Bedouin in Cyberspace, a Villager at Home. You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio. The Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs notes on their website that British-ruled Jerusalem was partitioned in 1947 for Arabs and Jews. The Israeli website offers a recording of the vote by the UN General Assembly.
The resolution of the Dutch Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Israel violated this declaration in 1967 with an occupation of all of Jerusalem. They declared it annexed. Israeli leaders later attempting to enact a law declaring Jerusalem to be Israel's eternal and indivisible capital. UN Security Council Resolution 478, adopted August 20, 1980, declared this so-called Jerusalem law to be void.
The connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem cannot be denied.
In fact, it's Palestinians, not Jews, who are being denied access to Jerusalem.
The Jewish people were building Jerusalem 3,000 years ago, and the Jewish people are building Jerusalem today.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, however, resurrecting the Jerusalem laws, declaring Jerusalem for Jews. Netanyahu was speaking at the March 2010 AIPAC meeting in Washington, D.C. We turn now to international legal expert Francis A. Boyle, who represented the Palestinians during peace talks about this very subject.
As for Jerusalem, no one recognizes Israel's claims to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. In the partition plan, Jerusalem was supposed to be a corpus separatum, apart from both the Palestinian state and the Jewish state contemplated in the partition resolution. That is why today the vast majority of states that have diplomatic relations with Israel have their embassies in Tel Aviv and not in Jerusalem, including the United States. The United States does not recognize Israel's claims to either East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem. Indeed, the last official articulation of this position was by George Bush Sr., at the United Nations Security Council when he was ambassador for Nixon, I think, to the United Nations. And I have that speech in my book, Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law. Indeed, in the Oslo Agreement signed by Rabin and Arafat, it clearly said that the status of Jerusalem would be the subject of negotiations in the final status negotiations between Israel and Palestine that were to open 5 years after the signing of Oslo, which was 13 September 1993. In 15 November 1988, the Palestinians issued their Declaration of Independence for the State of Palestine. They are now recognized de jure by about 127 states. I think the last two were Venezuela and Costa Rica. They have de facto diplomatic recognition by most of the rest of the world. They have all the rights of the UN member state except the right to vote. And tied into this was a peace initiative that I discussed in my book in great length. I was the legal advisor to the Palestinians on all this. And part of this was officially to accept the partition resolution 181 of 1947, the two-state solution. So the Palestinians have been on record officially since 1988 in favor of a two-state solution. Unfortunately, this is now March 2010, and they still don't have a state of their own. And it doesn't really look that the two-state solution is going to survive much longer. I regret to say it was my advice to President Arafat that they go ahead and do this. But all these many years later, it looks like it's failed. I hate to say that, but I guess I have to be realistic about it. I hope I'm wrong, but I can't say I'm overly optimistic. In any event, it was the Palestinian Peace Initiative that then led incoming President-elect George Bush Sr. to go to President Reagan and say, look, I want to do something here for the Palestinians on the Middle East. Could you please recognize what the Palestinians did? And Reagan himself opened what was called a diplomatic dialogue with the Palestine Liberation Organization in December of 1988 that continues until today. And it was that opening of the diplomatic dialogue between the U.S. and the PLO, going back to Reagan, by the way. We're not talking about a liberal Democrat. We're talking about a conservative Republican. And acting at the behest of Bush Sr., that paved the way then for the opening of the Middle East peace negotiations at Madrid that were opened by President Bush Sr. that he had been planning to do as president-elect, although it was interrupted by Gulf War I. But right after Gulf War I, he had Jim Baker go over there and negotiate out the terms for letters of invitation and assurances, and the negotiations opened. And as I said, unfortunately, Shamir and Likud's strategy was stall and delay forever. That's always been their strategy. But unfortunately, Rabin was murdered, and there's really been no progress at all since Rabin was murdered.
Professor Boyle, where do you see this heading?
Well, unfortunately, I think Netanyahu is trying to provoke a third intifada, just like Barak of Labor and Sharon, then of Likud, provoked the second intifada that later resulted in all the suicide bombings. I think Netanyahu is trying to provoke all that, figuring it's only going to help him out, shore up his shaky internal coalition over there. It would get him support from the United States and sympathy for the rest of the world.
Frank Barat is coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, held in Barcelona in early March, where those testifying included Nobel Peace Prize winner Mairead Maguire and a member of the Goldstone Report investigating team on Gaza.
The tribunal really is a call from civil society towards ending Israel impunity in the Israel-Palestine conflict, but also towards exposing the support that Israel receives from third parties such as, you know, European states or the U.S. or bodies such as the U.N. or the EU, states that enable Israel to actually violate international law and do what it does in Palestine. The first session really focused on who gives the weapon to Israel. Since Barcelona, we've really tried to have a very legal process, which means that we couldn't really get attacked, because if you base your work on international law, Geneva Convention, international jurisdiction, it's very hard for your enemies, in brackets, to actually attack you. So the conclusions of the tribunal are legally based, are just talking about UN Geneva Conventions, international jurisdiction, and many various aspects of international law, asking actually states, instead of just issuing statements and condemning the building of settlements, condemning the blockade of Gaza, to actually take action to stop the violations by Israel. So since Barcelona, we've a delegation from the tribunal met with the EU Commission in Brussels. They also met with the Spanish Parliament in Spain, and we're organizing now meetings in the UK as well with MPs, MEPs, etc., to present our report and our findings.
Frank Barat, we know there's overwhelming evidence about the U.S. providing weapons to Israel, including white phosphorus that was used during Israeli attacks on the U.N. compound in Gaza. But you had a member, too, of the Goldstone investigating team on Gaza, and he was at the Russell Tribunal. What were his findings?
Colonel Desmond Travers, who is an Irish retired colonel now specializing in weapons and in weapons used during times of war, gave a really chilling presentation in Barcelona, because he thinks that all weapons such as phosphorus and dime bombs, etc., should be banned from countries' military arsenal. So he said it's not about not using these bombs on civilians, etc. Those bombs are so dangerous that they should be banned altogether from any military arsenal. Again, we had Desmond Travers, but we also had Derek Sommerfield, who is a health specialist from the UK, saying that what happened during the Gaza war was that Palestinian paramedics were confronted with burns and injuries that they've never seen before, and a lot of lives could have been saved if actually they knew what caused those injuries. For example, white phosphorus, you cannot extinguish the fire. The more air it receives, you know, the flame starts again. If you put water on it, the flame starts again. So people were severely burned, and the medics, the paramedics, couldn't really do anything about it because they didn't know what caused such injuries. So Colonel Desmond Travers made a point on all those weapons It's not about, oh, the US is viewing them, the UK is viewing them, France is viewing them, Israel can view them. No, it's about they should be completely banned altogether, because the goal of those weapons is actually to target civilians. And you cannot avoid civilians with white phosphorus or with dime bombs or with flechette bombs. So if targeting civilians is actually called terrorism, you know, we're just confronted right now with state terrorism.
This week we've been speaking with people in Palestine about their inability to travel between places like Jerusalem and Bethlehem.
I mean, I've met lots of Palestinians that are very religious and, you know, they want to pray in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, so in Jerusalem. But Jerusalem and the Old City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque is pretty much off limits for any Palestinians living in the West Bank. So I've met people in the West Bank, people who live in Bethlehem. If you take the wall out, Bethlehem is about a 5 or 10 minutes drive to Jerusalem. You can take a bus. Yeah, it takes 10 minutes. People in Bethlehem haven't been able to go and pray on Fridays, the holy Muslim day, at the Al-Aqsa Mosque for 9 years, for 10 years. People have asked for permits repeatedly for their kids, and they haven't been able to do so. So when Israel and the government claims that it respects all religions, etc., it's completely false. Again, at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it's completely off-limits. People have to ask for permits that they never get, and there's more and more violence now because the Israeli government is sort of digging around the mosque, etc., to apparently find some remnants of, it's pretty much to prove that, you know, 3,000 ago, like, the Jews were living. And so Israel is digging all around, you know, the old city, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which could really endanger the mosque itself. And they've pretty much destroyed like a Muslim cemetery. So, yeah, those facts are hardly mentioned, but that's something we should work to change, really.
What happens now, Frank Barrett, to the Russell Tribunal on Palestine? Where do you go from here?
From here, we move to London. So we're actually working on the next session of the Russell Tribunal, so at the end of this year, and we'll focus this time on corporations and companies profiting from the occupation. So very briefly, the occupation is illegal. So if you are a company and you make money out of an illegal situation, you're therefore in illegality yourself. Major corporations are making a huge, huge profit out of the suffering of the Palestinians, the building of the wall, building of settlements, and international corporations, corporations in the US, in France, in Belgium, in Ireland, etc. So that's what we're going to focus on in our next session. And also, because the tribunal is also a mean to revigorate the international solidarity movement. So you've got already lots of initiatives that have started and a lot of those companies that have been taken to court, etc. Our role is also to reinforce their action and to show that it's a legal process and it's a legal matter, and that if only people and governments were respecting what they preach, this conflict would have been ended a while ago.
That's it for Sprouts. We heard Russell A. Boyle of the Illinois School of Law, Professor Mazen B. Kamsaya, author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, and Frank Barat, coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio, thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact Air Traffic Controller Ursula Rudenberg, URSULA, at pacifica.org. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio in Storrs, Connecticut. See you next week on Sprouts.